This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 25th, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court issues rulings in several closely watched cases blocking part of Arizona's controversial immigration law and ruling life without parole for juveniles violates the Constitution. South American leaders condemn the removal of Paraguayan President Fernando Lugo. And we'll go to Bolivia, where indigenous communities are marching to the capital to protest a planned highway that they say threatens nature and their livelihoods. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Celebrating crowds remain in Cairo's Tahrir Square a day after Mohamed Morsi was officially named Egypt's first freely elected president. The Muslim Brotherhood candidate will take the reins of a government mired in chaos. Morsi has pledged to include other non-Islamist parties in his cabinet, but it's still unclear what powers the president will have. Egypt's military council has made recent moves to maintain control over virtually all government decisions, and negotiations over how they will share that power continue. U.S. President Barack Obama called Morsi to congratulate him on the victory and pledged continued U.S. support for Egypt. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he looks forward to continued cooperation with the Egyptian government. In a speech on Sunday, Morsi says he will respect all international agreements, possibly a veiled reference to a 1979 peace treaty with Israel. Turkey's deputy prime minister says that Syria fired at a second Turkish plane in the past week. This one was a search and rescue plane searching for wreckage of a warplane brought down over the Mediterranean on Friday by Syria's air defenses. This comes as a cadre of top military officers have defected from Syria and taken refuge with their families in Turkey. FSRN's Jacob Resnick has more.
A Syrian foreign ministry spokesman said today that the Turkish reconnaissance jet had come in fast and low, and its air defense gunners reacted automatically when it brought the plane down with machine guns on Friday. The two pilots have yet to be found. Turkey admits its plane strayed into Syrian airspace, but claims it was shot down over international waters. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton criticized Syria's response, and an emergency meeting of the NATO alliance is scheduled for Tuesday. But despite rising tensions, a military response is unlikely, as Turkey has not invoked the mutual defense clause of the NATO Charter. Syria is known to possess state-of-the-art air defenses, a key deterrent to outside intervention in Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's crackdown of an uprising that's cost an estimated 17,000 lives over the past 16 months. Relations with Turkey were already at historic lows, as Turkey continues to host insurgent Free Syrian Army fighters on its soil and receive military defectors. Turkey's state media reported today that 33 members of the Syrian army, including a general and two colonels, had sought refuge in Turkey with their families, adding to the nearly 33,000 Syrian refugees that have fled Turkey to escape the fighting. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
In Sudan, demonstrations against austerity measures and the regime of President Omar al-Bashir continued for the 10th day as the government announced it will not back off a policy of ending fuel subsidies. The protests began among students but have spread to other sectors of the population and to cities besides Khartoum. Police have used tear gas to disperse several demonstrations over the past few days. Videos show demonstrators burning tires and throwing rocks. Opposition political parties, some of whom are hoping for a large-scale rebellion, say at least 15 of their members are among hundreds detained or arrested since the demonstrations began. Residents and police clashed in the summer capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir after fire gutted a 200-year-old renowned Sufi Muslim shrine. Shahnawaz Khan reports.
Residents of Srinagar flocked to the shrine of Dastgir Sahib early this morning, as soon as the news of the fire spread. Soon after, angry protesters fought with police and firefighters, blaming them for a slow response. Witnesses say the blaze started from the roof after the dawn prayers. The cause of fire was not known immediately. Clashes spread to other localities, with protesters chanting pro-freedom slogans. Police said at least 20 people, including 10 policemen, were injured in the clashes. The shrine is believed to house relics of a Sufi saint, Sheikh Abdul Qadir Jilani, popularly known as Dastgir Sahib. It's revered by majority of Muslims in the region and draws visitors across faiths. The local government said all the sacred relics and rare manuscripts in the shrine were safely retrieved and promised its reconstruction. It also ordered an investigation into the causes of the fire. Separatist and religious leaders called for a shutdown on Tuesday to mourn the loss and called for an independent investigation. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
A group of U.S. postal workers began a four-day hunger strike to protest looming cuts to the postal system. It's the culmination of months of protests across the country against plans to reduce service in rural areas, close distribution centers, and end overnight delivery of first-class mail. The demonstrators want Congress to eliminate a unique requirement that the Postal Service maintain a large pension surplus, which they say is responsible for many of the service's financial woes. Protests and rallies are scheduled throughout the week in Washington, D.C. They are also targeting the Washington Post because of numerous editorials by the paper in supports of cuts to the Postal Service. And those are today's headlines. For Free Speech Radio News in Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down several key decisions today on campaign finance, life sentences for juveniles, and state immigration law. In American Tradition Partnership versus Bullock, the High Court cited Citizens United in reversing a Montana court's decision upholding the state's 100-year-old law that banned corporations from spending on political campaigns. In a case with implications for youth prisoners, the court ruled that sentencing a juvenile to life in prison without parole is cruel and unusual punishment. We'll bring you more on that decision in a moment, but first we take an in-depth look at the court's decision on SB 1070, the controversial immigration law signed into law in Arizona in 2010. The court struck down several provisions of SB 1070, but upheld the right of the police to ask suspected undocumented immigrants for their papers. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
The Supreme Court's ruling invalidated three of the four sections of SB 1070 up for review. Those making undocumented immigrants register with the government and carry a registration card, making it a crime for undocumented immigrants to seek work or work, and authorizing the police to arrest undocumented people without a warrant. But the justices upheld one of the most controversial pieces of the law, which allows police officers to check the citizenship status of anyone arrested for any crime. Delivering the majority opinion, Justice Anthony Kennedy expressed a basic uncertainty about how that provision will be enforced and warned the law could have constitutional concerns if state officers detain individuals or delay releasing them for the sole purpose of checking their papers. Attorney Xuming Cheer with the National Immigration Law Center told FSRN she shares that concern. She's part of a coalition of legal and civil rights groups pursuing parallel cases against SB 1070, which can still go forward after Monday's Supreme Court ruling.
We believe it's unconstitutional because it does conflict with federal law, but we're also extremely concerned that it violates the Fourth Amendment and that it leads to racial profiling because anybody who looks like an immigrant or speaks English with an accent, they'll be asked for their status and also be detained while law enforcement verifies their immigration status. Often there's an assumption that if somebody is a person of color that they are undocumented.
Five of the nine justices on the high court sided with the federal government, but did not address the issue of racial profiling. Justice Elena Kagan recused herself, having previously worked on the case for the Obama administration, and the remaining three took Arizona's side. In his dissent, Justice Antonin Scalia argued that all of the provisions of the law should have been upheld, and repeated points he raised during oral arguments in April.
Arizona has no power. What does sovereignty mean if it does not include the ability to defend your borders?
As the court's ruling became public, immigrants and their citizen allies in Arizona vowed to continue organizing against the remaining provisions of the law. In particular, several organizations have sued the state for criminalizing undocumented day laborers. Jennifer Chang Newell with the American Civil Liberties Union says this and other pieces of the law threaten fundamental rights of both citizens and foreign nationals.
Undocumented immigrants are persons within the protection of the Constitution. They have equal protection rights. They have a right to due process.
Thousands of Arizona activists held a mass protest on Saturday at one of the most notorious immigration detention centers in the state, a tent city run by Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Arpaio is currently being investigated by the Justice Department for racial profiling and human rights abuses. Juanita Molina with the Border Action Network says SB 1070 has emboldened Arpaio and vigilante groups like the Minutemen to take actions against Latinos in the state.
What this law has done is confirmed some of the racism and hatred that's existed here in the state. It's made it acceptable. It's made it palatable, much like in the civil rights movement when we saw the Jim Crow laws, in our daily lives. It just sanctioned the dominant culture to continue to oppress a group.
Arizona resident Adelina Lopez has experienced this firsthand. She told FSRN how the passage of SB 1070 affected her community.
There is a lot of fear ever since the bill was introduced, and the community loses its trust in the authorities. If you're ever in trouble and you want to call the police, you're scared that you might be deported.
Lopez and other immigrant rights activists are gathering at Tucson's Federal Building Monday to demand an end to all racial profiling and discrimination in the state. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The Supreme Court ruling on Arizona's SB 1070 could have implications for a number of other states, including Georgia, South Carolina, Indiana, and Utah, which have passed their own immigration measures. One of the harshest is in Alabama. The state's controversial HB 56 law is under review by a U.S. Court of Appeals. For more, we go to Shay Farley, legal director with Alabama Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. She also works with the Alabama Coalition for Immigrant Justice. She joins us from Montgomery. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me, Dorian.
So how does today's ruling affect Alabama's immigration law, HB 56?
It's an excellent question. The court's decision was very clear that the federal government's authority is not only supreme, but exclusive. Thus, I think that we will see sections 10 and 11 of HB 56, which are virtually identical to sections 3 and 5 of Arizona's law, struck down as unconstitutional. The question will remain about that pesky little remaining section, which is section 12 in HB 56.
That section 12 in HB 56 you're referring to is similar to section 2B of Arizona's SB 1070. That's the provision that allows authorities, police, to ask for papers of people they routinely stop. Is that right?
That is exactly correct.
And how is the provision in Alabama's law different than SB 1070's?
More because it's not an straight to the magistrate or straight to law enforcement. There's a little bit more discretion in HB 56 than there is in Arizona. But more specifically, in Alabama, we have done a much better job, I guess because we had more time, in showing the true human impact, the social impact, the division on communities, basically the profiling, the discriminatory impact that this is actually having on the ground in Alabama.
And quickly, what's the update on the court challenge at the 11th Circuit for the Alabama state law?
Okay, in Alabama, the Supreme Court decision will now that it's decided, the 11th Circuit will have to read it and figure out for itself, the three judges that sit on that panel, how that decision can be applied or should be applied to Alabama's law.
Shay Farley with Alabama Appleseed and the Alabama Coalition for Immigrant Justice. Thanks for the update.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court also issued an opinion in Miller versus Alabama, a case challenging life sentences for juveniles who commit murder. In the 5-4 decision, justices said life sentences without parole for youth under 18 violate the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. FSRN's Nesna Savadov has more from Washington.
The High Court examined two cases in which 14-year-olds were sentenced to life in prison without parole for their roles in homicides. In Monday's opinion, the court took issue with more than 24 state laws that require juveniles die in prison and prevent a judge or jury from deciding whether the age of the defendant or the nature of the crime might merit a lesser sentence. In the decision, justices cited two previous cases, Roper v. Simmons, which threw out the death sentence for children, and Graham v. Florida, which ruled that juveniles cannot be sentenced to life without parole for non-homicide offenses. Alicia D'Addario, a senior attorney at the Equal Justice Initiative, which represented the petitioners, said the decision was grounded in court precedent.
Today's decision is a very important win for children. We commend the court for recognizing the fundamental unfairness of mandatory death in prison sentences that don't allow the sentencer an opportunity to consider the unique status of children and their potential for change.
Justice Kagan was joined by Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor in the majority opinion. In his dissent, Chief Justice Roberts wrote that while determining the appropriate sentences for a teenager convicted of murder presents grave and challenging questions, the court's role is to apply the law, not to answer such questions. An estimated 2,500 people are currently serving life without parole sentences that they received while they were juveniles. Youth and prisoner advocates hope Monday's ruling might mean some of these prisoners might not have to spend the rest of their lives behind bars. Nesmith Savadoff, FSRN, Washington.
This is FSRN reporter Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico. Free Speech Radio News has been a crucial outlet for my stories on social movements in Mexico, the so-called drug war, and the real-life effects of U.S. policies here south of the border. But FSRN is facing a situation in which it could go silent. Find out how you can support independent grassroots journalism at fsrn.org.
In Paraguay, the removal of Fernando Lugo from presidency has drawn condemnation from regional leaders and sparked protests within the country. Lugo, who had one more year in his term, was formally impeached by the Senate on Friday on charges related to a police operation earlier this month to remove peasants from land that led to an estimated 17 deaths. Lugo's election in 2008 ended more than 60 years of rule by the dominant Colorado Party. His vice president, Federico Franco, has assumed power. For more, we're joined by Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
How was Lugo removed from the presidency so quickly?
Well, the Congress just did it. They had kind of a kangaroo court kind of trial, which they called impeachment, but it wasn't much of a trial or an impeachment. It lasted 4 hours, and they gave the president's lawyers 2 hours to defend him, and they had only given less than 24 hours to prepare a defense. So there wasn't anything that would resemble due process, which is actually provided for in Article 17 of the Paraguayan Constitution.
You talked about the speed of this process. The impeachment charges came down on Thursday, and then the trial took place on Friday?
Yes.
And what was at the center of the impeachment charges against Lugo?
Well, the main pretext that they used was this confrontation between their last week. There was a land conflict, and 17 people were killed. So they used that, and of course the media there is very much against Lugo, so they somehow tried to make it look like it was his fault, although he didn't have anything to do with it. And they took advantage of this kind of climate of hysteria to move on him.
Land reform is a central issue in Paraguay. How extensive is the problem of land ownership and the disparity there?
Well, it's the worst in the Western Hemisphere from the data that's available, and really probably the worst in the world. It's 1% of total land holdings there are more than 3/4 of the total land.
Lugo had one more year in his term. When he was elected, he ended more than 60 years of rule by the dominant Colorado Party. That was in 2008. What's your assessment of his time in office since then and his ability to address this disparity in land ownership?
Yeah, he hasn't been able to do very much, but the groups that are organizing for land reform and other social movements are still supportive of him. That is a big issue, and the landowners are extremely powerful, and of course, they basically control the Congress.
Well, as you mentioned, despite this lack of progress on this issue, he still maintains support from many of the peasant groups. And after this impeachment announcement came down, we saw protests in the streets and support for him. Talk about the Colorado Party and his vice president, Franco, who now is assuming power, and what their stance is on these issues.
Well, the vice president is from a different party, and he's very much going to support the powerful interests there, including the landowners. And so it's a completely different thing. It's not like a vice president that would take over here. And they just don't want to, I think, open up the space for these social movements to be able to organize. I think that's what they were really afraid of. They were looking ahead, and I guess I'm worried more about repression now at this point. You know, today it was reported that Lugo has called for people to protest peacefully, and that he's formed a shadow cabinet, a shadow government, and so I think it could be dangerous. I mean, this was a country that has been repressive. It's been a dictatorship for, you know, most of the last 70 years. And these institutions that come from the dictatorship are still very much entrenched, including the Colorado Party.
The Organization of American States has expressed concern about Lugo's removal and the way it was done. His removal has also been referred to as a coup by Ecuador, Venezuela, and others in the region. What has the U.S. response been, and what's next in this situation?
Well, the U.S. response has been discouraging because they, you know, at first made a couple of comments about due process, but then after, since Lugo has been formally removed from office there, they've been quiet. That silence after the removal really sends a strong message. It's similar to what they did in the coup in Honduras in 2009. If you remember, the very first statement that came out of the White House right after the coup was one of the few in the world that didn't condemn the coup. And that is the way they send the message to the people who pulled it off, that we're on your side. They can't say, they can't congratulate them openly. The silence is the way you send that message in diplomatic circles.
Mark Weisbrot is co-director for the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
In Bolivia, a march is underway to protest a controversial plan for a highway that would cut through the Amazon. After a protest last year by indigenous inhabitants of the area where the road is supposed to be built, the project was delayed but not canceled. President Evo Morales said he still plans to build the road. The current march is now on its way to the government seat in La Paz. FSRN's Peter Teffer reports.
After arriving in the small Bolivian town of La Embocada, a group of indigenous people set up their camp and make some music before retiring for the day. The group is part of a 300-mile-long march against the plan for a road through an indigenous territory in the Bolivian Amazon, known by its acronym of TIPNIS. The marchers include indigenous inhabitants of the TIPNIS, but also people from other communities or cities. These marchistas left from the Amazonian city Trinidad at the end of April, and so far have walked around 200 miles. They hope to arrive at the de facto capital of the country, La Paz, later this month. This day they've been marching from San Borjas, a leg of around 13 miles. Along their journey, they chat or listen to the radio. Juana Bejarano is one of the marchers. She's wearing a red cap and is carrying a pole with a figure of Maria. Like most Bolivians, she's of the Catholic faith.
The motive of our march is to defend our territory and its nature. We don't want the government to destroy TIPNIS, which belongs to us.
This is the second march in defense of the TIPNIS within a year. The previous march arrived in La Paz last October. That effort helped to put pressure on the government, which decided that the park would be intangible. Soon after, however, another march occurred of Bolivians who do want the road to be built. The Bolivian government responded with a law that required a consultation process to be held, a sort of referendum. Carlos Cayuba is mayor of Concepción de Ichua, a village in Tipnis. He says that the consultation process comes too late.
Well, look, after analyzing this with the other local leaders, we concluded this was a false law because the consultation process still had not been held before the contract was signed.
The marchers say they're offended that the government didn't consult them before signing a contract with a Brazilian construction company. This right to prior consultation had in fact been recognized by the same government a couple of years earlier when it introduced a new constitution in 2009.
What they fear is the legal precedent, the right to prior consultation, is enshrined in the constitution.
Dario Kenner works for the Bolivian Climate Change Platform, an organization representing various indigenous movements.
There are other indigenous territories titled, they're called deseos. So they're worried that what could happen in the Tipnis, which is an indigenous territory titled, in fact the title was given to the 64 communities by Evo Morales, they're worried that in their other indigenous territories, which are of a certain amount of hectares and are demarcated, where there are also natural resources in terms of oil, gas, mining, they're worried that the same thing will happen in their territories.
Although the contract with the Brazilian company OAS was cancelled in April, the Bolivian government has repeatedly stated it still wants to build the road. The political forces pushing for this highway are very powerful, says Jim Schultz, the director of the Cochabamba-based Research Institute's Democracy Center.
In one direction you have Brazil, that, you know, up until recently was both financing and essentially building the highway. And Brazil says it wants a highway because it wants a better land route to the Pacific. I personally think that's not true. Anybody who's ever dealt with roads in Bolivia knows that there's no such thing as a reliable land route. It just takes one blockade and your trucks aren't going to get through. What they want is access into the Tipnis because they want access into the natural resources, including oil, that exist there that they're already investigating and exploiting. On the other side, you have the coca growers in the Chapare who want more land on which to cultivate.
The coca growers are influential because of their connection with President Evo Morales, himself a former coca grower. There has been some confusion about who will be included in the consultation process. If the coca growers that live to the south of the Tipnis area are included, their vote might be decisive. Dario Kenner says the question of who should be consulted is critical.
The ILO Convention 169, the UN Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, make it very clear that the right to prior consultation is of the communities within that indigenous territory. It's not outside.
The start of the consultation process has been delayed a number of times. It is now set to begin on July the 10th. If all goes well, the marchesas by then have already reached La Paz. Peter Seffer, FSRN, La Embocada, Bolivia.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Andrew Stelzer. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. Washington, D.C. intern is Neth Smith-Savadoff. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org. And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.